And good morning to council and those listening and watching in this third of three oral arguments we have today. Judges Bratfold and Klopphockey are joining me. Judge Sleater in this third matter, our file number A210900. When council begins your statements, if you would identify yourself and whom you represent for our record, we are recording this proceeding and the recording will be available on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours, so we prohibit any separate recording in any method of this proceeding. Can both counsel see the clock in the corner of your screen?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And so 15 minutes apiece and then 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant if you choose. And so if we have any difficulties with our connection for any reason, the marshal knows to stop the clock and then until we reconnect with you. And so with that said, if counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michelle Olson. Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel, and may it please the court. I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Khan Turok. This is a dissolution matter that has been going on for several years. The parties originally dissolved their marriage on April 11th of 2016. Throughout the next couple of years, we have been dealing with an issue regarding the division of property and how to properly give Mr. Turok the property division he was awarded and agreed to. We are asking the court at this time to reverse and remand the district court's order denying my client the ability to enforce a sale of a home. And specifically, we are also asking the court to make clarification either by fixing the original decree or the amended document to actually put the true intentions of what the parties had agreed to and what was put on the record, or in the alternative, to order that a sale can happen and it can be enforceable due to my client's inability to receive his property division because of the court's original order.
I gather that the operative order we're talking about is the order of September 2017. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that order, the language says if the wife is unable to remove the husband from the mortgage by a certain date, then the wife must put the home up for sale after 30 days. Well, the rest of the language has no requirement for sale. And in fact, by the time, she was able to get, I don't know how she did that, but she was able to get the husband removed from the mortgage. So it seems to me like the requirement to put it up for sale, the predicate for that never occurred.
Your Honor, I think that is where the heart of the matter lies, is what the agreement actually was for the parties.
That's what it says. I mean, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. However, the actual agreement of the parties wasn't.
The sale requirement is only if she's unable to remove the husband's name. Well, she did remove the husband's name. So that negates any requirement for sale, does it not?
I respectfully disagree. I think under the instrument, which is faulty, which is actually where the issue lies, we are asking to modify the decree or correct the decree.
Let's start at one thing at a time. The language you said that the operative order was September 2017, and it starts out with the requirement that she has to put the home up for sale only if she's unable to remove the husband's name, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is what the instrument
And she was say. Able to move remove the husband's name. So how does that if sentence have any requirement in it to sell?
The issue, Your Honor, is that the word remove was the improper or inartful term.
Okay.
Within
so
the
you're,
document.
You're not disputing what the plain language is.
We are not disputing what the instrument
And you're not
says.
Disputing whether it's ambiguous or not.
We
it
are not.
Ambiguous, does it? It does not appear to be ambiguous.
I believe it is a conditional statement, and I believe it's clear under the written instrument what is being described on a sale. However, what we dispute and what we do think is ambiguous is this removal of the name issue, Your Honor. As you pointed out, no one understands how that could have happened. And what the parties actually had been discussing and what was put on the record was a refinance, not a removal.
Can I clarify something, Ms. Olson? That I think part of what you're getting at is I agree with what Judge Klopaki's premise is. And that's why I assume the parties were discussing it as the judge is typically removal of a name requires a refinance. But I got to clarify, though, for you. Does your client factually dispute, or did your client factually dispute with the trial court that his name was removed?
No, there is no factual dispute from what we understand that it's.
So then I'm not following how the word removed can be ambiguous in the sentence. He agrees it was satisfied and it was required. And so his name was removed. And it happened to be without refinancing, but I look at all the prior orders. It looks like because everyone presumed as they should, refinancing would have to occur. But, and I think I used to tell parties this when they were pro se, that your refinance doesn't happen automatically. Removing a name doesn't happen automatically, but one party's responsible and one's not, but it's an obligation. So I'm not getting the importance of the method by which the name was removed when the requirement was to remove the name.
Your Honor, that I think is the crux of the issue. The requirement wasn't to remove the name. The requirement was to refinance the home. So therefore my client could get the proper property division. He would not have been able to get it without that. She did not have the cash. We believed that a refinance would be required. Plus, we had an additional issue with the taxes being garnished because his name was still technically on the mortgage when we did the initial decree. That is where we're saying the issue lies with the Rule 60.
Let me back up. Is my understanding is that both attorneys got together before the judge issued that September 2017 order. And had some input as to what that order was going to say. Is that true?
Your Honor, there were negotiations and we put the full agreement on the record. But
that full agreement on the record is the exact language of if the wife is unable to remove.
No, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree. That is not actually what it says. We are talking about a refinance.
About what occurred before September 2017. Some months earlier.
No, Your Honor.
All the other discussions that were going on. But how did the September 2017 order come about?
There were negotiations, Your Honor, and then upon agreement to refinance the home.
No. Procedurally, how did it come about? How did the judge get the language that it used in the September 2017 order?
Respondent's counsel, prior counsel, drafted the document, Your Honor.
And submitted it to you to your side for review?
We did review it, Your Honor.
And you did or didn't?
We did review it, Your Honor.
Okay. And that document as submitted by opposing counsel and which was reviewed by your side had this same language that the trial court put into that September 2017 order?
We don't dispute that the judge adopted it. However, the judge adopted it improperly. It did not match the agreement that was placed on the record.
An agreement that was predating September 2017.
It would have been the one that we would have enforced, Your Honor. It was the one that was being memorialized.
My question is, the procedural posture of this is that the two lawyers got together and proposed the language to the judge. Both sides reviewed it and submitted it to the judge, and the judge adopted it. Is that a fair statement?
I think you have, you're procedurally missing one of the steps, Your Honor. What happened was we had a negotiation.
I'm not interested in the negotiations. I'm interested in knowing how this got before the judge.
And that's what I'm explaining,
Your Honor. And I gather whatever took place, I gather there was some discussion, some negotiation, but the language was prepared by opposing counsel and submitted to your side, and your side acquiesced in it in some fashion to get it to the judge. Is that a fair statement?
Your Honor, what happened prior to that is we put on the record what the agreement was.
My question, a difficult one. I tried to summarize the procedural posture, and I want to know if that's accurate.
I think you're missing part of the procedural
posture. Well, I understand that. But what I said, was it accurate?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. It's not accurate. When you put an agreement on the record, that changes the procedural posture.
When did you put the agreement on the record?
The agreement that was put on the record, Your Honor.
The one that you're referencing. When was it put on the record?
May 18th of 2017, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. And what took place after that?
Then the parties started drafting the document, Your Honor. And then after that, we reviewed the documents. We submitted to the judge to adopt to make sure it matched what would have been on the record on May 18th, because that is the actual agreement that the parties made. And then it got adopted by the court. There are references to the removal. However, when you look at the actual record on the May 18th, 2017 trial, we discussed the fact that we said the word removal does mean refinance, that we were using it as it's an inartful term. And I don't dispute that.
Can I clarify something, Ms. Olson? You lost me a little bit there where you said you submitted it to the, so obviously you approved the language, otherwise it wouldn't have been submitted, I assume, because you've been negotiating for 4 or 5 months. Are you telling me that counsel agreed to ask the judge to look at our proposed order, match it with what we said on the record, and if it matches, sign it, but if it doesn't, don't? It strikes me as an odd, and it's not something I as a judge would ever have done. I would have shipped it back. Well, no, if you're not in agreement, I'm not signing it, and I'm not looking at it. So I'm not following that aspect of your answer.
No, I understand, Your Honor. No, per the rules, when there is an agreement that is placed on the record, the judge is to review it to ensure that it is adopted based on the actual record that was made. Again, if someone...
But the point being, though, is what you're referring to. I mean, obviously, at that stage, the judge will presume what we know here, and I think it's safe to say not all details of the agreement number one were put on the record in May. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, not the ones that were.
Well, then why did it take until for the counsel to agree on a proposed order until September?
Your Honor, I will be honest, I don't remember. I know Respondents' Counsel was the one who first drafted. We received it. I know we were trying to obtain information regarding the mortgage at the time, but I don't remember all the details. Obviously, it's 2017 and now I'm in 2022. So it's been a little bit of a while for me.
Okay. Well, I'm going to kind of accept the part of where you wanted to get to is the record. You've submitted some documents in the record as to what was said in May. If I'm the judge looking at that, it would seem to me if by the point as your client was saying that's incorrect, well, then I would look to the record to see what's correct. And I don't see any statement said on the record that our agreement is that the house shall be sold or shall be refinanced by May 31st. I see all kinds of language about talking about refinancing. We've already covered that because everyone fairly presumed to get his name off, you're going to have to refinance. But I don't see any clear language that the judge could have looked at to say this language that Judge Klopach is referring to in the order is absolutely wrong. And it seems to me under the case law, the rule you're referring to, the only way a judge could change is if there's clearly an error. So, for instance, if our agreement on the record is mother gets sole physical custody and an order comes to the judge that gives father sole physical custody, that would be an example of what you're referring to that would clearly be an error.
Your Honor, I do think this is an error, though, because we have specifically said that it's not a removal of his name. It was a refinance. The fact that removal got used instead of the word refinance is a clerical error. However, even if the court were to not agree with the 60-01 rule and to apply that, much like in Johnson v. Johnson, where they had somewhat of a similar situation where the names were flipped. It was an inartful word. It's one word that got changed and it was improper. And
it's not one word. It's to remove the husband's name from the USDA mortgage by a certain date. That's the language of the order.
That is correct, Your Honor, but it's a refinance that was required. And that's what was as of May 18th of 2017. That's what the parties expected. That's what the trial court anticipated it to be. The
fact it may have been parties expected it because no one probably thought that she was going to be able to refinance it.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, it still was the anticipation of the parties to have
it. I have some question about the whole idea about having a lien, and it was pretty clear that he expected there was going to be some time before he's going to get the money.
That is correct. However, no one expected 5 years. And I don't think it's unfair. And that's kind of where we get into the second issue.
No one expected 5 years, but then this occurs on September 2017. And then 3 years go past, isn't it? Before anybody says, well, wait a minute, there was a problem here. That's not consistent with the desire to get the matter promptly refinanced or sold so I can get my money.
Although your time's expired, please do finish. You can answer Judge Klapacki's question there.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I guess I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate the situation we're in. However, the problem we have and the issue we have here is a Rule 6001 has no requirement that it has to be 3 years. The fact that it was 3 years could have been 12 years. It wouldn't have mattered. The party's intent and the party's requirement on the record and what they all have agreed to, what the judge agreed should happen based on the fact that we needed to submit an order, was a refinance. For now, because the respondent's counsel put removal, appellant's counsel approved it because we based it on our belief of the requirement, doesn't remove the intent of what the parties had. And that's why you have the ability to have a 6001 to actually apply the intent of the parties and their agreements, which was made on May 18, 2017. That was the enforceable contract, not just this. And it goes further into my second argument, which I didn't have time to make, and I'll make in rebuttal. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Olson. And counsel for respondent, if you would please identify yourself, you may then proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Herman. I am the current attorney representing the respondent. Her name is Nyawan Dock. Distinguished panel, I thank you for the opportunity to talk today. I do have three basic points I would like to summarize.
Ask you a question first. Were you involved in the discussions that led up to the submission of the proposed order to the trial judge for the September 2017 order?
No, Your Honor, I was not part of that discussion back in 2017. That was a different law firm and a different attorney. I have been in contact with that attorney, but I had nothing to do with that case at that time.
Okay, thank you.
The three points that I would like to make, therefore, would be according to Minnesota Statute 518.145 Subdivision 2, appellant's motion is not timely and it should be dismissed. The second point I'd like to make is that appellant has failed to demonstrate that this was a mistake or a clerical error under Rule 6001, and that the language used in the stipulation was not ambiguous and it does not need reformation pursuant to contract principles. And the third point I'd like to get to is that even if we were to provide the requested reformation that appellant seeks, it wouldn't be substantively fair to the parties at the time that of implementation and is therefore not allowed by our case law. The point being, and I think is well understood at this point in time, that the parties did come to a stipulated agreement that they provided to the judge back in September of 2017. Throughout the whole case, which dates back to approximately 2014, parties were represented by counsel. There was plenty of ongoing negotiation, and terms were added and subtracted and removed throughout that negotiation, as most negotiations would do. They put some of them on the record at various times, including a written order in April of that year. And they then had the discussion on the record that Ms. Olson has discussed in May, about a month later, but then it wasn't until September that the parties finally came together. During that time, my client's attorney wrote and drafted the original brief, submitted it to appellant's attorney. Appellant's attorney, in an email, sent back the language that they wanted, that they had chosen, regarding the removal from the mortgage and the insurance by December of 2017. That language does not say refinance, even though that was one method they had discussed as an option to remove the name.
Was that email part of the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the trial court had that to consider?
Yes, Your Honor. The Minnesota Supreme Court, in the case of Shirk v. Shirk, states that once a judgment is entered based on a stipulation, the sole relief from that judgment requires meeting requirements outlined in the statute 518.145 subdivision 2. In order to gain that relief, appellant would need to show that there has been a mistake, and they need to do that in within 1 year. Otherwise, they're time barred from bringing the motion. So from the outset,
appellant says, okay, so we're time barred by the statute, but we're going to go under the rule.
Correct. So if we're talking about, I assume you're referring to the clerical error rule, Your Honor?
6001.
Right. So if we're going to go under the rule of 6001, I don't believe that they have provided enough evidence to show that there is a clerical error here. And if we're going to look at what a clerical error would mean, the court in Egg, the Egg, would classify that type of error as something that is a more substantial nature and not just a mistake of removing or replacing a name mistakenly. Is you had used the example earlier of saying appellant instead of respondent. I mean, that is a simple mistake that can easily be changed as a clerical error. It does change what was intended, and it's clear to the parties that if one was supposed to be obligated to do something and the other one was listed, that should be switched. However, what appellant is asking us to do is actually replace an entire concept of removal with a refinance. And those are two different things. As can clearly be shown, respondent was able to remove the name of appellant from the mortgage and the insurance, and thus released him from any financial burden, which was part of the bargain that he made. Whether she did it through a refinance or not is not material, as refinance was never the only option that was considered. And I would point to the fact that in the previous April 2017 order, prior to the oral agreement on the record, it does not say that they had to refinance in order to remove the name. It says they need to remove the name and nothing more. What was left open was the timeline by which the name needed to be removed. And when they got to the May hearing, the oral hearing, the transcript that's been provided, the judge is clearly trying to clarify in that transcript what the timeline was going to be and what the methods might be. And at that point in time, through negotiation, it was believed that refinance would have been one of the options. The district court...
Mr. Herman, can I take you back to that? You're referring to that April order, and I think that's the one I have in front of me at paragraph 4. The heading of that paragraph is refinancing a mortgage to remove respondent's name. But then in the body of that language, it says the parties agree that respondent's name shall be removed from the mortgage and mortgage insurance. The parties do not agree on the amount of time petitioner will have to remove respondent's name from the mortgage. The timeline shall be decided at the upcoming evidentiary hearing. So I assume that's what you're referring to, that the upcoming must have been the May hearing. So how do you interpret, is that the part of that order you're referring to? How does that play into then what was talked about at that May hearing and as to that language that we're dealing with that Judge Klapacki has been asking about?
Yes, Your Honor, I am referring to that order. That is correct. And what you noted is that the only time refinance is used is in the title of that paragraph. It doesn't say how it's to be refinanced, when it's going to be refinanced, what the terms of appropriate refinance would be. It just talks about that as being a method to remove the name of the appellant from the mortgage. And therefore, when they got to the May hearing, they were discussing that as an option. Can she refinance at this time in order to pay? What they didn't have an amount of what was going to be paid at that point in time. All of those details were still being worked out. Respondent was able to remove the name by the end of it without the need for a refinance. And as we move forward in that hearing, the district court currently relied on that transcript and the facts therefrom, stating that the final September 2017 stipulation on this point essentially matches the April 2017 order, where removal is what is required. Then the district court pointed out it was the appellant who stated to the judge at the time that they would be sure to include the appropriate language for a refinance. The appellant was then instructed by the judge at that hearing to add their chosen language. The appellant confirmed to the court in that transcript that they would add their language. Then they had the opportunity to do so for the remaining 3-4 months from May to September. The chosen language that appellant actually added does not talk about a refinance. And I quote, they added the language, if petitioner is unable to remove respondent's name from the USDA mortgage by December 31st, 2017, petitioner must put the home for sale after 30 days. Then after that, appellant had opportunity to review their chosen language with their client and respondent, and respondent's then counsel. Everybody agreed to it, signed it, and sent it to the court. Then appellant lived for 3 years, 2017, 2018, 2019, without apparently expecting payments from that lien through a refinance or a sale, because they didn't say anything. And the first time that respondent hears from appellant is in 2020, arguing it's always been his intention that he was going to get paid by the year end 2017. The district court did not find this 3-year wait persuasive, and they don't find this a clerical error when coupled with all of the facts above it. This wasn't a mistake. This was purposefully chosen language based on the agreements that the parties had made.
Mr. Herman, have you shift gears just a little bit? I don't see that this was directly asked by appellant's counsel of the judge, but a bit troubling. So I'm jumping ahead. You cite the case law that seems accurately to reflect that a district court does retain jurisdiction to enforce liens. And we know that dissolution law is generally considered equitable. My question is this: I was a bit troubled by the lack of a due date to pay. But I can't tell, as I say, that the judge was directly asked that, because it was all these issues related to correcting an error, clerical error, Rule 6001, and et cetera. Would you agree? So as it's written right now, until it sells, and it looks like from the record she has no intention to sell, the only way he would get his money is if she voluntarily sells. But literally, there's no other timeline. So if she died and deeded it to her children, and they wanted to live there because of the sentimental value, would you agree? I mean, essentially, it could go on perpetuity until the last heir died and there's a sale, and her client and or his heirs would receive. And so I'm just asking, would you agree that I realize that's not what was asked here, but that's a remedy that would be available for appellant to simply go to the judge. And the very simple question is, we would like a due date. And it could be, whether like in Nelson case where the kids all emancipated and no longer living in the home, something along those lines. But would you agree that's a remedy that would have been available and is available now for the appellant? Now the court can deny it, but at any time to ask the court to do order.
Certainly, Your Honor. I understand your question is it a remedy to do? And I would agree that a remedy to sell the home and pay off that lien, right, by a certain time is a remedy, right? She could refinance at any point in time as long as she qualifies for refinance. In fact, the respondent did attempt to do that in 2020, which is part, and she was denied based on her current.
But just to clarify now, if she refinanced because his name's already off, she doesn't have to pay anything from the refinance. What the order says is when the home, the party shall cooperate to remove respondent's name. So that's been met. If unable by December 31st, she must put the house up for sale. So the point being is right now there's no obligation at any particular timeline to pay the money on the, for the lien until and if the house is sold.
I would agree that that is what the language states. And I would also state that my client has no intention of not paying the lien, whether it be through refinance or by a sale. But there is no timeline at this point in time which she must do that by. And that is part of the bargain that the couple made when they were going through the divorce. And why they made that, there is no evidence to support on either side. It is what the bargain was. She got the use of the house and he got relieved from the financial obligations from the house. Does that answer your question to that?
Yes, point? Indeed. Thank you.
Okay. That being said, I think it brings us to the next point is that while we don't believe there's clerical error here, if we were to have to make a motion to the court and ask for a remedy, the remedy that's been for sale of the house and 4% interest, that's more than what they originally would have been bargaining for. And that's not allowed under case law, as it wouldn't be substantively fair to the parties. The case law suggests you can get no more or no less at the time of implementation or modification of these types of awards. And further, we would look at this as a final property division and not a support award. And final property divisions are just that. They're final without the extra, you know, proof of evidence of mistake or fraud or clerical error, which appellant has not been able to show to this judge. And the judge's findings of fact cannot be set aside under civil procedure rules. Therefore, this whole
Mr. Herman, very well. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that. Therefore, the district court's order should be affirmed at this time.
Very well, thank you, counsel for appellant. You will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, as soon as you see that in the clock, which it's now there, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make a point very clear. The original trial court on May 18th of 2017 said, quote, you can't make a court order that says his name comes off the mortgage and make it applicable. That's not going to happen. The court knew and intended, and as we agreed further down in the record, it says by respondent's counsel to respondent. And is that your understanding of the agreements? Is that an accurate reflection of the agreements that we've discussed before coming into court this morning regarding the lien that will be secured against the home, the time that you have to refinance, and the additional items that we need to verify to determine the exact amount of the lien Mr. Turok will receive in the home. The reason why we had some issues with a full determination on the lien is because there was an outstanding tax dispute of whether or not respondent had paid the taxes as well as Mr. Turok. There was a double potential payment. There was
also, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to clarify, and you heard my reference to the April order. You look at all the orders and all the discussion, the number one issue was indeed to remove his name. And so my question to you, and you've shifted our focus to say, no, the main issue is to refinance. Two questions is, so are you telling me that if she would have refinanced and his name stayed on, she'd have been in compliance with the order? And secondly, isn't it true that at no point during that hearing did the parties say, we have an agreement for the method by which my client will receive the money? One, that it be refinanced but if it can't be refinanced by December 31st, then it shall be sold. Because I didn't see that language, and that seems to be what you were asking the district court to change it to. And for our review, consider that an error.
Your Honor, I believe what was discussed was it had to be a refinance or that he would receive the money through a sale. I think, again, the issue was the timing, as well as we didn't know the exact terms for the amount, but not the method. We all knew the method was a refinance.
Whatever the discussion was early on, when we got to May and the time between May and September, all kinds of discussions took place. And then, as I understand it, the council represented that the draft, that the language that and made its way into the order was submitted to your side, that by an email, your side agreed that that was the appropriate language, and that isn't that now a, whatever the language was earlier, isn't that now the new agreement?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it was the new agreement.
Why is it not?
I think the...
Why isn't it a new agreement?
Because the oral agreement was the proper agreement. There was no additional, there was nothing additional.
I understand that argument, but if there's a subsequent agreement in writing, and if your side by email agreed to the proposed language, why isn't that a new agreement?
Because that email wasn't submitted to the court when we initially did it in September. This was after the fact, an after the fact statement or comment by respondent's counsel. What was agreed upon on the record is what should have been done, which is why we have rescission.
Didn't appellant's counsel agree to this language?
Appellant's counsel agreed to the language based on their understanding.
And memorialized that agreement by an email?
They emailed regarding certain terms. I would heavily dispute that is the implication, or it was implied that the refinance was on there. That's not what
that email was submitted to the trial court?
It was submitted to a different court, not the original court that adopted the agreement, Your Honor. So I don't agree that it would be considered a change of the party's actual agreement that was made on May 18th. This was an after the fact.
The court explained that September order had before it a proposal of language for the order, which is in the order, and an email from the appellant's attorney that was appropriate?
No, that is not correct, no. Your Honor. That email didn't get given to the original trial court in September. It was given to the trial court in 2020. That's why I'm saying there was no showing that they actually had changed their agreement originally.
So how was it submitted then to the court in 2017?
Electronically through EFS, Your Honor, a proposed order was given to the court. That's all that was given.
And no indication by everyone agreeing to it?
Your Honor, it was submitted by proposal. There was no letter, I believe, that was submitted that said, yes, they've made changes or made agreements. It just got submitted as is.
But appellant's counsel had a copy of it in advance of that submission?
And I see my time's up, and I know he's asking questions. May I proceed?
Yes, you certainly may answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. There is no dispute, and I don't think appellant or respondent are disputing that both parties were able to see the document and were able to see it. However, the contemplation that was made was put on the record on May 18th of 2017. The trial court specifically said the intent of the parties was this refinance. Respondent's counsel said it's a refinance. Appellant's counsel says it's a refinance. I do not dispute, and no one is disputing, that this document has created an issue. The problem we run into now is how to fix the issue that's been created. We are asking to do it in two different ways.
Well, you could have fixed it within 1 year, clearly, under the statute, right?
We could have if that's what we were going for, but we were not going under the statute, Your Honor. We think it's a clerical error.
Well, you had 1 year under the statute to fix it. You didn't do that.
Well, we didn't believe it was inaccurate at the time. I believe within the 1 year, we realized the issue later on, Your Honor. And that would not have been...
December 31st came along and there was no sale. And then a couple more years went along, and only then that someone looked at the 2017 order.
I guess, Your Honor, I understand your point that yes, it was a couple of years, but if the legislature and the Minnesota judiciary did not believe that you could correct contracts and other things without the year, we wouldn't have a Rule 60 or one, or we wouldn't have several common law case laws like Nichols v. Sherland National Bank, which was a Minnesota Supreme Court case in 1980. Theros v. Phillips, which is a Minnesota 1997 case, Fritz v. Fritz, which is a Minnesota 1905
case. None of those are family law cases, are they?
No, but they deal with contracts, which is what divorces are. They are written contracts between the parties, Your Honor. And I believe that's why we have these rules. It's a common law practice.
We also have a case law that indicates that property settlements in family law cases are to be permanent. Again, not subject to all kinds of changes when somebody doesn't like the result.
I agree with you, Your Honor, and that's what the problem is. The district court has now taken my client's property award, which isn't the marital lien, it's the amount of money, and has told him, you can't get money, you can't get paid, you have no recourse. And you, because it was requested to do a sale in 2020 because of this issue, and the court said, nope, it's too extreme, you're not allowed it. Which means my client now doesn't have his property award, and respondent gets to keep the entire property award, which wasn't given to her, which wasn't contemplated, and it wouldn't be proper or fair for my client to now have nothing because of something that was inartful, which is why courts are allowed to retain jurisdiction and modify or fix it. The court has chosen not to do any of that and basically has said my client can't have his award, and that is not fair or proper, and that is why we're asking to reverse. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We will now take the matter under advisement.